Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue. As today we talk about novel agents and approaches and strategies in the management of higher risk myelodysplastic syndromes. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Guillermo Garcia Manero from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and Dr. David Solomon from the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa. We also have some additional investigators on the faculty, and we gave everybody a short survey of their usual treatment practices, and we're going to integrate that as we go along here today. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room, and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We put out a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey for you to take. If you do that, we'll learn a little bit about you, and you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We do webinars all the time. We're going to be doing one on Thursday. It should be really interesting, on melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancer, another year in review program. And I can tell you about half of the slides, there are things I've never even heard of. It's really amazing what's going on there, particularly in terms of immunotherapy. And next week, we have a program on bispecific antibodies and myeloma, already one approved and more on the way. We'll see what these investigators have to say about that. And then on Thursday, July 20th, we'll be talking about ER-positive metastatic breast cancer, a huge issue at the recent ASCO meeting. We'll get into a lot of the issues that came out there. And then we'll be continuing our soft tissue sarcoma and connective tissue disorder program on July the 25th. And then on Monday, July the 31st, really expanding issue now in oncology, the management of a non-metastatic prostate cancer. A really amazing EMBARK study just presented at the AUA meeting and many other new studies that we're going to be talking about. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a program we did with Dr. Stone on AML and MDS papers from the recent last ASH meeting. But we're here to dissect out the higher risk MDS. And as all of our Inside the Issue of programs, I met with each of the faculty individually. We recorded a comprehensive presentation for each of them, really worth going through. If you can check that out, we put the links to these presentations in the chat room, but we'll also be emailing links with when we send out this program very soon. Here are some of the data sets that the two faculty members went through in their presentations. We're just going to pick up a little bit of this. If you really want to see the details, check out both of these presentations. They're really, really informative. Here's the issues that I picked out from these presentations to chat about today, some of the clinical implications of new data sets and also our research implications as well. I want to start out with the issue of the biology of MDS and AML. And David, I think, you know, to most of out there in the general medical oncology world, first of all, MDS itself is a real challenge, I think, but trying to understand the overlap and the biology of MDS as compared to AML, here's one of the slides from your presentation that got into that. But maybe you can just talk about a little bit your vision of sort of what the borderline is. You know, one of the things that's come out, David, is the issue of blast number and how that, whether it's 10%, 20%. From a practical point of view, David, how do you visualize this?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, so I think one update in the WHO, you know, we're still MDS, but we're now myelodysplastic neoplasm. Just emphasizing, you know, this is a, you know, true malignancy actually with the higher risk and subtypes, you know, such as P53, which gets highlighted on the slide too. It's actually worse than almost any metastatic, you know, tumor. So just to speak to the sort of morbidity, mortality. So I think for those who are, you know, maybe not fully aware, of course, the WHO came up with their recent update, but then in the sort of world of blood cancers, there's this international consensus classification that also came out. And you can see overall there is a lot of harmony between the two systems. But I think one thing that did came out in the ICC, which has raised a lot of discussion, is sort of this MDS slash AML category, speaking to your question a moment ago. And so now this 10 to 19% blast, which would have formerly been RAEB2 or now IB2 by the WHO, has this MDS slash AML. So the blast cutoff, used to be 30%, then dropped to 20%. Now we're discussion here. I think the importance of this, and there does need to be unification and harmony, which are efforts ongoing between ICC and WHO, is that there can be a lot of overlap. And really the underlying mutations, that patients have is probably what matters more than anything. I think we'll see this in a little bit. For P53, we're ready for this harmonization, although I would argue that we should probably make that cutoff at 5% and not 10%. And then there are other mutations, NPM1 mutations, those are really AML. And again, if you have a 12% blast and this is now recognized as, AML defining, we should treat it such. So it's just that there is a lot of overlap. And I think my real hope is that it really will open up treatment options for all of our patients, especially as we get new therapies approved. We don't have this arbitrary divide where we, can't get something, approved for our patient because they have 21% or 19%. This is nonsense. I think at the same time, I think we have brought about a lot of confusion. And even how you discuss this with patients, what's my disease? It does bring about a level of complexity that I think is going to have to continue to work out amongst both academics and community physicians together.
Guillermo, any thoughts? What we're trying to do tonight is get you just to talk about it the way you talk on rounds. Your presentations have all the data, but I just want to try to pull out from you, things that people keep in their head. And this concept, Guillermo, to me is extremely confusing. Anything you can do to help enlighten us?
Not really, because actually it's funny that I usually 100% agree with David, but we're starting the conversation where I disagree. So this is how I see it. This is a diagnostic classification. It's not a therapeutic classification. It's not a prognostic classification. Diseases are entities. And you should not change a name just because you want to do all these things that David wants. That's insane, with all my respects to you, David. For that reason, actually, we should just remove all... Let me give an example. And actually, I was very vocal at IHA about this. If you have P53 mutated pancreatic cancer with 3 months survival, and there was a drug that treated that, and then there was some other disease with the same mutation with 3 months survival, oh, we should call it the same name just because this way I can treat both. I disagree with this. I think if you have myelodysplastic syndrome, you probably have dysplasia. And actually, I will say that just because you have poor prognosis doesn't really mean that you have acute myelogenous leukemia. Indeed, actually, it's so funny that, actually sad, I should say, that a lot of the MDS have worse prognosis than AML. So I don't really understand why we're going away from morphological diagnostic classifications into this kind of very confusing things where this, and then there is the politics in terms of academic behind this, where a group of people, I hope David is not offended, I don't know if you're on that paper or not, they decide because they are not co-authors in some paper, they want to create their own classification. I don't understand it, actually. I think you have dysplasia, you have myelodysplasia, and then you have whatever prognosis, you have whatever mutation, that's how it should be called. So I don't agree with this. Now, there is an effort to put this all together. Actually, it's ongoing. I think David and I are part of the same, and hopefully we'll come with a final good answer. I think this is very confusing, David, Neil. I think it's in transit. And what bothers me actually is the timing, because as we will hear a little bit later from David, for instance, hopefully in the next few months, we'll have some positive trials that are very important for this disease and high risk. How is that going to all pan out when we have these kind of names? Now, on the other hand, it's not that the WHO classification is perfect either. For instance, they decided, I don't know why, based on whatever data, to change the name. I don't know if you realize that. So now this is called myelodysplastic neoplasm. I don't know. It's some idea like the same, to make it easy for insurance to do something. Okay, look, we spent 10 years making sure that people understood that when you have myelodysplastic syndrome, you have other comorbidities such as cardiovascular disease. We discover why that is, because you have a TET2 DNMT3A mutation. So we remove the syndrome from this. And now the papers have to say myelodysplastic neoplasm in parentheses MDS. I think this is too much of an academic kind of discussion. I think the timing of the name of these changes is not really kind of right. I think these conversations could happen next year when maybe we have phase three trials with positive data or not, and then we adapt. Right now, it just adds a little bit of confusion. So I feel like you, very confused about how to take these names.
Well, I feel like I'm moving forward a little bit. I think I understand a little more than I did 5 minutes ago. You know, any kind of concept. I don't know if I told you that we did a program recently with your colleague Rich Stone, and he made the analogy of MDS is like the bone marrow is like a factory where all the workers are drunk. So that kind of explanation that sort of resonates with me a little more than some of the more technical ones. Anyhow, so let me show you a slide, David, that was actually in Guillermo's talk in terms of the algorithm. I'm going to let you respond to what he put here in terms of sort of how he thinks through management of higher and lower risk disease. Any comment, David?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this, you know, really hasn't changed, you know, for a long time. I think, you know, if you have lower risk disease, and I think we can talk, you know, for a long time what exactly that means. I think I do have improved prognostic models. Again, how we incorporate all these into treatment are still some open discussions. But again, if you have a lower risk, you know, clinical patient, you know, you're treating the symptom that they have. So if there's a certain blood count that is low, you try to make that better. Of course, we have lenalidomide for the Del5Q patients, and we do have, you know, immune therapy, you know, immune suppression. Aggressive therapy, ATG cyclosporine, which actually gets, you know, missed as a potential option and can be quite useful in a small subset. But patients, and then for our higher risk patients, we really have HMA. I think intensive chemo in certain, you know, patient populations, especially potentially going to transplant. I think Guillermo was highlighting on age. Again, consideration there is there. It's probably also underutilized, you know, to some extent. And then transplant is just part of the course. And I think what I like is this sort of little dashed line, I think, which means that, hey, we're starting to transplant older and older patients. Actually, I have an 80-year-old as of today is going forward to transplant in about 2 weeks, you know, treated with sort of, you know, an HMA venetoclax-based regimen. So that age group is continuing to get better. And I think part of that is we get better therapies, better responses, better performance status improvements, at the same time improving the morbidity to transplant. That's the key. And I think the one big thing is, as soon as you're thinking high risk, you're thinking about transplant. And I think, unfortunately, too often we get the referral at the end. Hey, they had 7 cycles, 8 cycles, 10 cycles of HMA. What should we do now? And then if they progressed or not responded, that's a really bad group of patients. So if you're starting high risk, really up to the age of 75 and maybe rarely older, they really need a referral to a transplant center simultaneously. And again, ideally, that sort of initial treatment decision is a collaboration between the two groups even before that first dose of HMA, if possible.
So Guillermo, anything you want to add to that? And maybe you could sneak in a word about luspatercept and the Medalist study and where that's heading in lower risk disease.
I mean, that was one of the major things that we saw over the last couple of years, right? So we had not gotten any drug approved for like 14, 15 years. And then 2 years ago, we had the oral decitabine cedazuridine approved, and then luspatercept for second line patients with lower risk transfusion dependent with this particular type of MDS that we refer to as ring sideroblastic anemia. As we discussed through these presentations, you know, at ASCO and EHA, we heard the COMMANDS trial that is actually published already in The Lancet, with the frontline study in any MDS comparing luspatercept versus epoetin alpha. That is a very positive trial, in my opinion. So I think we're starting to see quite a bit of change also in lower risk disease. But I would like to go back, Neil, for a second, because David is right on target. And I think the point that he made is really dramatic, actually, and people may not realize we're really transplanting more and more. And I think it's a combination of, at least in academic centers with research trials, more effective combinations. I think we're going to be discussing a lot of this later. The fact that, you know, we can do that safely. And now, you know, we're transplanting patients routinely in the mid-70s, of course, with good donor, good performance, and good response. And David had a very beautiful presentation at ASH a couple of years ago showing actually what is the impact of this kind of good bridge to transplant, effective transplant, and then, you know, you are able to give some maintenance therapy, you know, showing in very high risk, poor prognosis, let's say P53 mutated patients, better than expected outcome. So I think this is where we're going. We're transplanting actually more patients than ever with high risk disease.
So we're about to get to the slide that both of the faculty agree is the most important thing we're going to talk about today, and something that was a big surprise to me when I talked to the two of them. But let's just talk a little bit about the background. So this really starts out with, in terms of the issue, IPSS-M. David, can you explain what this is and what the implications are from your point of view?
Yeah, sure. So this was an international collaboration, you know, really all continents, you know, numerous investigators and thousands of patient samples basically, you know, came in and this was led by, you know, Eli Papamanuel. So basically sequenced ton of genes and then looked at what their impact on prognosis. And so now there's this molecular IPSS. There is a app, a very actually easy, you know, tool, Android, iPhone, you know, usable. It allows for missingness. So let's say your center doesn't have one of the mutations, MLL-PD, PDD being a main one. For example, I don't have that one at my institution. You can click, you know, not assessed, and it can still sort of predict both an overall survival, leukemia-free survival. It basically has two weighting systems. One system weights specific genes that have adverse risk. That's sort of in the top part. And then the other part weights the sort of absolute total number of mutations, you know, together. And so it uses that, our older clinical, you know, such as, you know, blood counts, blast count, cytogenetics. I mean, it does assess for sort of this P53 allelic status or multi-hit. It puts it all together. And now instead of five categories, we have six. And again, it gives you a little bit more personal prognosis. Hey, what is a survival? What is a leukemia-free survival, you know, of a patient? Again, how we're really incorporating that treatment is really unmet questions that we really need to answer together. But it's clearly a great prognostic tool and can help, you know, discuss more personal information with your patient.
So, Guillermo, this is one of the slides that you showed that kind of gave an example of how a mutation status can affect risk. Can you comment on that?
Yes. So this is a very intuitive process. So if you allow me, I'll go 10 seconds on the history of this. So around, let's say, 15 years ago, people started showing a number of genes being mutated in this disease. And then the logical question actually was, do they have prognostic value? Indeed, actually, Rafa Bejar from San Diego, I don't know if he published this or not, but presented a very nice slide that all of us have used, showing in a very intuitive way that except for SF3B1 gene, that is a good prognostic characteristic, as you accumulate mutations, prognosis is worse. So zero is okay, one is a little bit worse, two is worse, etc. So that was actually the emphasis for the IPSSM effort that, you know, Elsa and Eli Papamanuel should be congratulated, because it's a really large international effort. But, you know, our group tried to like look at this in a more rudimentary, smaller cohort a number of years ago. And as you see in the slide there, for instance, if you have more than, if you have three or more genes mutated, the hazard ratio is like having a P53 mutation. Now, there is detail in these days when we did that analysis, we didn't know about the BAF. So this is something now that is evolving, basically the variant allelic fraction. So there is more nuance, more detail in terms of what we do nowadays. But it's clear that if the disease is more molecularly heterogeneous, you have more mutations, outcomes are worse, no matter how you look at that.
So we asked the faculty, how do you evaluate, what genes do you evaluate? And everybody says they would use the IPSS genes, and that calculator is a great way to do it. We also asked the faculty, you know, this is the way we do consensus. We ask a question, everybody says the same thing, we call it a consensus. So I'd say there's a consensus, at least within the faculty, that they want to see the NGS before they start treating a patient. This is the one that surprised me. I sort of assumed that the patient goes from being low risk to higher risk. You're going to treat them like a high risk patient. But then we ask the faculty, almost everybody says, well, not necessarily. So, and I don't know if other people had the same sort of assumption or not, but obviously it's a pretty important issue. David, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think if there's one maybe take-home message, other than obviously some excitement, you know, that we're all looking forward to in the high-risk setting in the near future, it's, again, the IPSSM is a great prognostic tool, but we're still learning how to use it. And you want to take your patient in front of you, what is their clinical presentation? And the biggest thing is, you have a patient that is clinically lower risk, let's say they're asymptomatic, and now they're, you know, moderately high, you know, that does not equal an automatic trigger to HMA. There's actually zero data to support that. And actually, there could potentially, you know, be harm, you know, in some settings. Because what are you really trying to do, especially in, let's say, patients that are not transplant, you know, eligible? So that should not be a trigger. I'm now molecularly high risk. I initiate HMA. Now, again, these things may continue to evolve as we get new exciting combinations, and maybe early intervention may matter more, but we're not there. And so I do think it may... I think about the patient different. I have now a molecularly higher risk. I may have them evaluated by transplant, maybe have a donor ready. You know, could, you know, there is some data to support potentially early transplant intervention. Again, I think we need to bear that out more, larger, you know, data sets to collaborate that. And that work is actually ongoing. But again, you need to use the patient, the clinical presentation, what's the goals of the patient, transplant, yes, no, and all that together. I think the IPSSM can be a helpful tool, but it's not something you have this, I therefore do this. That is not the right thing to do, at least as of right now.
So, Guillermo, from your point of view, for docs in practice outside a trial setting, what do you recommend? Should you just, you know, you can say to the patient, or you know yourself that you, maybe the prognosis is worse, but you're going to treat the patient the same, HMA, or not?
No, I think David said it very well. So it's difficult to rephrase it, but I'll try to give it a little bit of a different spin, because we're talking about two different things. And it's actually similar conversation the way we started. Like, I disagree with David, like, okay, just because you have 17% blast, you should not call this AML. Okay, so let me see if I can make it a little bit simpler. What this means is the IPSSM is a very, right now, powerful tool to tell you without treatment, this is your prognosis. Because most of these data sets, as I understand, don't have data in therapy inputted into them. So, you know, you have this condition, your survival is 10 years or it is 3 months, whatever it is. Okay, fine. But that doesn't 100% mean that whatever therapy we have is effective in that context. If you think about this, you know, the hypomethylating agents as single agents have actually limited activity. So that's why actually we wanted to develop this classification. So it may be that in the next few months or next year, someone at ASH or whatever will say, oh, in the context of IPSSM, indeed, actually, we're going to discuss this with maybe the EXL1 mutation in a few minutes, a little bit later. We will find subsets of IPSSM that do very well with HMAs and some that do very poorly. But right now, you cannot generalize because that data has not been generated. And the bottom line, Neil, is if the hypomethylating agents were 100% effective, yeah, maybe you will make that assumption, but they are not. And I think that's what we're trying to say. We need to figure out how IPSSM works in the context of therapy. This is not well understood. So these are two different things. Prognosis is one thing. Therapy decision is another. And just because you have poor prognosis, it doesn't mean that you have to do particular type of therapy. It may not work. Prototypical example, a stem cell transplant and P53 mutation, it does not work that well.
So as you mentioned, we have a number of really exciting trials that are maturing and hopefully going to be reporting soon. I know both of you are extremely optimistic about this. We're going to get into that. But one other issue that I wanted to touch on, and Guillermo got into this in depth and certainly has done a lot of the research, which is the issue of oral HMAs. And I'm just going to ask you, David, what your view is on oral HMAs and in what situations You right now you're using oral decitabine.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're all looking for, you know, quality of life, patient convenience, and you know getting parenteral, you know, azacitidine or decitabine 5-7 days in a row, or may stretch over 9 days with, you know, that's a lot. And a lot of patients may have to travel far even to get to even a community center. So I think having that oral option is definitely an amazing way to potentially improve quality of life. I think there's a lot of logistical challenges in the beginning. Costs, speed of getting it, and even, you know, compliance and how they're sort of tolerating their disease and seeing them. I think those are issues that I think even scare academics, you know, at time. But where I personally use it is, you know, a lot of times, and this was actually kind of how the original, you know, trial that Guillermo led, you know, I may start with IV and, hey, they tolerated it really well and they're doing fine and I feel comfortable. Maybe by that time, all the copay and everything else. And I then transition them to, you know, oral decitabine, you know, let's say with cycle two or cycle three. Actually, that's what I do regularly. I do think, you know, and actually Guillermo's group is doing a lot of this work, you know, hey, you know, a lot of the exciting combinations have predominantly been done with azacitidine, and their approvals may potentially even be azacitidine specific. But again, it's likely very similar. And when we think about all oral options, let's say oral decitabine venetoclax, and again, Guillermo can maybe speak about their data. I think we have to continue to learn that. I think it's going to be probably an equivalent option, but I think we're still learning, from that perspective. So it's a nice tool. It's still a little bit challenging, in my view, to use at times. But definitely for patients who are tolerating and responding well, I find that transition quite easy. I would say the GI toxicity and even sometimes the cytopenia toxicity, at least in my hand, feels a little bit different between PO and IV. Whether or not that's just my anecdotal usage of it or not is an interesting, consideration. But again, Guillermo's, really led this effort, with several others from the beginning.
So Guillermo, I'd like your comments. Also in your talk, you talk about sort of some of the studies that are using oral decitabine instead of azacitidine, and some of the doublets that were being looked at out there. But what I'm particularly curious about is the presentation you gave just a few weeks ago at the EHA meeting, looking at oral decitabine instead of azacitidine with venetoclax. Can you comment a little bit first on the issue of oral HMA? And also, can you kind of walk us through this study, Guillermo?
I think this is actually evolving in a very interesting way, because when we started developing the oral azacitidine, not the oral decitabine, around 15 years ago, that eventually got approved in AML, we were very naive. We thought, okay, let's just get something easier that we don't have to give 7 days injections underneath the skin. For a big person, two or three injections can be painful, etc. And then this has evolved into this field where we have now one drug approved, this oral decitabine cedazuridine, and maybe the oral azacitidine is being re-studied in a large phase 3 trial in low-risk MDS. And we're starting to see a number of things. So first of all, these are fixed formulations for the cedazuridine of the decitabine plus the cedazuridine. It should be noted that there is a drug actually being developed that is the oral azacitidine cedazuridine. This is in very advanced phase 1 trial. It could actually be a drug that could be approved in a couple of years that could then perfectly emulate IV or subcutaneous azacitidine. If we are successful there, that actually could be very transformative, because David is correct. Azacitidine is the most commonly used HMA. But the bottom line is, people are working on, or we are working on, pediatric formulations of this drug. So this could be transformative for children. We're looking at different ratios to really try to figure out a proper dose of this particular drug for lower risk MDS, that may even lower than what we use in high-risk disease. David is correct. Sometimes this drug can cause cytopenia. Remember, it's a fixed ratio. So if you have a smaller person, or maybe there are some enzymatic differences, we see a little bit of cytopenia, more so than what you expect with the HMA. I think the doublets are very interesting. I think a lot of the studies that are now ongoing actually are testing somehow in parallel a doublet with an oral HMA, this oral decitabine cedazuridine. I think you're going to see data, for instance, this is kind of out there, but quite striking, with many inhibitors that are oral with oral hypomethylating agent. And by the way, this is not only in MDS, this is actually permeating into AML. So you will see at ASH, hopefully, and this was already presented, doublets and triplets with IDH1, IDH2, venetoclax, FLT3 inhibitors. So this is actually moving from the MDS to the AML part very much. I think you're going to see a lot of it. And David, at the beginning, was talking about personalizing and context. This is going to be all about it. Who will be the person who is a better candidate for this kind of therapies, whether they are better or worse, I'm not sure. I see that a significant fraction of patients in the near future will be treated with total oral approaches. That could be doublets and even triplets, actually.
So I want to show another result from the survey. This is based on a case that Guillermo presented during his presentation, David. Guillermo, can you just sort of summarize this case of a 78-year-old, I guess, not a candidate for transplant?
Correct. So comes with cytopenia. You do your bone marrow exam, has 15% blast, so high-risk MDS, and then has prototypical cytogenetic alterations, so 3 copies of chromosome 8. And then by the NGS, you have the prototypical mutations that you see in this disease, TET2 and ADNMT3A mutations. And then what do you do? And, it was interesting to see actually to my, should I interpret this, Neil, or do I let David go?
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, sorry. Please, please. Yeah, no,
actually,
go ahead, go
I was, when I voted for this, I was like, this is what I will do honestly in the clinic. This is actually a real case. So this person will be, this patient will be treated right now with a combination of oral decitabine, cetazuridine, and venetoclax. I thought I was going to be the outlier, but I was very happy to see that three other of my colleagues here, Dr. Brunner and Dr. Wong, actually thought about using the oral HMA. And two others actually believe that adding venetoclax, including David, was also appropriate. So I think this is starting to tell you that the whole group thinks in a very similar way. I don't think that you could argue today that azacitabine, oral decitabine is better or worse. And if you do, probably azacitidine is the one that should be kind of used based on the phase three old randomized data. But you see a theme here that the data is strong enough to actually recommend this kind of doublet.
So, David, any thoughts about the response here? You know, again, we talk about consensus or not consensus, but I see several people saying venetoclax and other people saying no.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a debatable one, and I think we're going to see a slight change in this case in a moment that we'll be able to speak about. But this is a molecular profile that can do decently well, you know, to HMA therapy. And I think based on how the patient looks, you know, again, frailty, not frailty, ability to come in frequently. I think the one big thing to think about venetoclax, you know, we use it extremely commonly at academic centers, but it's not easy, right? They require twice weekly labs, first cycle bone marrow biopsies, holds, adjustments. And so it's not all size created equal. We use 14 days of venetoclax in MDS. And so I think if there are concerns there based on that patient that's 78 that's not going to transplant, I don't think it's wrong to not to give single agent HMA. And I think that's really some of the heterogeneity in the responses. I'm thinking about what would I do in that exact scenario, and I would use venetoclax, because I like that the response rate's, better. And I think as long as you kind of tweak it and titrate and personalize a regimen, you know, many patients can have improved outcomes. So I do like it, and that's my choice, but I do understand sort of the single agent HMA choice in that specific setting.
Guillermo, any thoughts and also any comments on the Verona study? I think this is one of the studies we're really looking forward to see the results of. A lot of people have already sort of using HMA venetoclax in high risk MDS. Also, a question mark about how long you use the venetoclax. Guillermo, any comments about the data you presented and also the idea of using HMA venetoclax right now outside a trial setting?
So thank you, actually, because I wanted to make sure that we made this point. So actually, sometimes community physicians are faster than academic in kind of, taking some of the data. And I think because of the AML experience, venetoclax now, I can tell you, is very commonly used in the community practice. I see quite a bit of patients referred to me for a second opinion already on venetoclax. So this train is already passed. The community is doing that already, is, I believe, on the NCCN guidelines. But I would like to use this podium, if you allow me, for 1 second to make sure that the audience understands that we're not talking about 28 days of venetoclax or 21 days. This is the problem. I see patients that come to our practice in bone marrow failure with this kind of profile, the 15% blast, etc. But then you go back and the patient has been like 2 or 3 months with uninterrupted venetoclax. Maybe you do that in AML, I'm not sure, but for sure you do not do that in MDS. That's too much. So actually, if you look at the data that is coming out, data that we published last year, hopefully in the next few months, we start with kind of like 14 days, and a majority of the patients very quickly in the second, third cycle, they need to go down to like 7 days, 5 days, sometimes even lower. So these patients with MDS do not tolerate, and you should not treat them with extended dosing of venetoclax. That's very key. So for the audience, it's not like say, okay, we're going to use an AML approach here because these patients, they become cytopenic, the bone marrow kind of like dies, and many times you encounter them with an empty bone marrow, they don't recover and they do poorly. So that's something that I think is important to highlight. Thank you, actually, Neil, for that.
So David, we're also waiting for the phase three of sabatolimab, a TIM-3 checkpoint inhibitor. Comments you have about that, David? And also Dr. Kumar in the chat room has a case, 80-year-old high-risk MDS treated with HMA only, but has had a dramatic response in the counts. Should I add venetoclax, he says.
So maybe to handle the case, no. So I think especially you have a great clinical response, just continue that therapy, especially in an 80-year-old where we're not thinking, you know, necessarily about transplant and things like that. And there is actually decent data. You know, there's trials already, you know, run, you know, one presented by Amer Zidan a while back on HMA venetoclax salvage. We actually have some, you know, real world experience, and it is definitely a salvage option. I think it's actually an interesting consideration if we have multiple approvals, how we sequence that based on who has salvage activity and what setting. But definitely in that case, you have a clinical response. Same thing. They came to me, beautiful response on HMA. I'm continuing HMA monotherapy and not thinking about venetoclax. So to sabatolimab in your question, I mean, the mechanism is quite unique. You know, it has sort of almost a threefold mechanism where it can directly target the leukemic stem cell. It sort of blocks this feedback loop. So basically the cancer cell giving its own food to itself, this autocrine loop. At the same time, it blocks a negative immune checkpoint, kind of analogous to thinking about, you know, PD-1, PD-L1 type therapies. And it may do other things like augment antibody-dependent cellular phagocytosis from that perspective. I think, you know, the safety profile actually out of the combinations has been maybe the best, really quite limited, some immune-related adverse events that are quite easily reversible and potentially predictive of responses. And so I think what was unique with the development of sabatolimab is they went very fast into this randomized placebo-controlled phase 2 trial. Actually, this didn't, you know, happen with either venetoclax or magrolimab. These, to me, was probably the most important clinical presentation at this past ASH presented by Amer Zidan. And I think, unfortunately, it was negative. And I think that has, unfortunately, brought about a lot of pessimism and negativity about it. That being said, I think nobody should have hoped for the CR rate to be positive. And the CR rate was identical to single agent HMA in all the earlier trial. I think the hope is that the durability of response, which looked quite intriguing from the phase 1, you know, would pan out. And I think what's interesting here in these curves, maybe if you just go back just for one moment, is sort of this later separation. So clearly the p-value is not statistically significant, but thinking of immune therapy, you know, can the phase 3 trial still be positive? You know, what is nice in the phase 3 is it's a sole primary endpoint of overall survival. The safety is good. I would have actually liked a lot more development. There were some really exciting triplet combinations with sabatolimab that I would really like to still go forward. HMA-Ven, sabatolimab, HMA-Magro-sabatolimab. I think sometimes with negative readouts of trials, in my opinion, pharma gets too scared of these things and kind of just says, oh, we're going to wait for the phase 3 study. So we're all eagerly awaiting. There were some subsets, lower burden of disease, potentially molecularly lower risk patients. There's an ongoing trial in more clinically lower risk patients, you know, with sabatolimab. So I think we'll all await. There's definitely been some pessimism, but hey, if we have a p-value of 0.049, the enthusiasm will return. And I do think it's a nice combo drug, you know, thinking about the future if we did have multiple doublets.
So there certainly are a lot of examples where randomized phase 2 were positive and the phase 3 was negative. But here we're hoping for sort of the reverse. This is the phase 3 study you were talking about. However, I guess the faculty's not exactly betting on that had to happen, but hopefully we'll all get a pleasant surprise. Let's hear about another case, and we can again see how the faculty responds to this. So Guillermo, 70-year-old man, what happened with him?
Okay, so he's younger than the prior one, and this is a true case, also with excess blast 15, also with the same trisomy, but this gentleman happens to have this particular mutation, AXL1. And this patient actually is a candidate for transplant, has a donor, is in good shape. So what are the options? HMA, is a cytidine, the cytidine oral, the cytidine, what about a doublet with venetoclax?
So David, any thoughts about this? There's a little bit of heterogeneity in whether people would want to use magrolimab in this situation, which we're about to get into. But any comments about this situation, this case, David?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Guillermo and I are aligned that, you know, to me, the really key part of this case, especially off of study, would be the addition of venetoclax. And I actually feel for this case, I really think it is by far the best therapy. And again, obviously with respect to everybody's, you know, decision, but, you know, we looked at it a couple of different ways. So if you look at true CR rates, you know, to with ASXL1 mutation with single agent HMA, they're close to zero. These patients do very poorly to HMA. And then in contrary, this group seems to do extra well, even potentially, you know, better than other molecular subtypes as far as true CR rates with the combination of venetoclax. And so I think with both of those, especially a transplant candidate, I would highly, highly recommend, you know, the addition of venetoclax. Again, whether or not you do it to AZA, decitabine, oral decitabine, I think that is, you know, not the key point of the case. But I think, again, molecularly subgroups of patients, I think we're going to need to use it to personalize. That's why we're all waiting for NGS. This is actually one of the most important examples would be that the addition of venetoclax in this case would be quite critical. I was actually interested that there was some heterogeneity, but I think some people are, you know, sometimes still sticking to exact, you know, guidelines. But to me, adding venetoclax there is extremely important.
So Guillermo Tzedevan in the chat room wants to know, in the planned use of venetoclax for 14 days, when do you do the bone marrow, day 14 or earlier? We asked the faculty about dosing, and as you said, everybody says 14 days, also decreasing it for subsequent cycles. In terms of the bone marrow, here's the way the faculty responded. Guillermo, any comments?
No, I mean, I think you're going to give the 14 days in the first cycle, so doing a bone marrow on day 7. So the colleague is correct that in AML, we're doing this, right? So in acute myelogenous leukemia, when you give venetoclax, sometimes you do the bone marrow on day 14, and if the patient is kind of empty already, you stop the venetoclax. But, you know, here we're already giving a shorter course, so doing a bone marrow on day 7, I don't know that we have really done that, and I'm not sure that the dynamic of response is that fast either. So I will do the bone marrow at the end of the cycle, and I think most of the colleagues were agreement. You will do that in between day 21 to 28, whenever it's appropriate based on counts and so forth. So you will do that at the end of the cycle. But I should say that it's very important to do this bone marrow, because going back to our experience with single agent HMA, it's going to really tell you a lot in terms of how you're going to proceed. If this patient has still quite a bit of residual disease, you're going to march on. You're going to continue with the therapy. If the patient now is very hypocellular after the first cycle, you're really going to cut down on the number of days of venetoclax, and you're going to delay the cycle. So this bone marrow is very important, as opposed to single agent HMA, where people do this sometimes on the second cycle and the third cycle. So for a safety reason, you should really do that at the end of this cycle.
So I want to talk about magrolimab and TP53. And David, you presented this 67-year-old man. I'm going to get back to what happened to him, but here's the way the patient presented and the way the faculty responded. Can you go through how this 67-year-old man presented?
Yeah, so 67-year-old patient, really just trying to emphasize that this is a healthy patient without comorbidities, presenting with a classic, very high-risk disease, severe pancytopenia, 12% myeloblast, and has a variant allele frequency of 55. Again, this is the true biallelic multi-hit patient. Most of these patients are complex karyotype, as in this case. And so again, with that multi-hit P53 mutation, what ideally would be your first-line therapy?
So, Guillermo, can you comment on how you would think through this case? You say oral decitabine instead of azacitidine, transplant, yes. So and if you could get magrolimab, you would use it in a case like this. Can you talk about your thinking in this and what you think about some of the other answers here, Guillermo?
Yes. So let me walk you through how we think about this. So if we had seen this patient, let's say, a few years ago, let's say 5-6 years ago, there would have been a question, he's 67, about should I give him induction therapy, like AML program, like what we were discussing earlier, cladribine, erasive, venetoclax, or 7+3, whatever it is that you do, versus HMA. And the data is very strong. These kind of patients don't do well with AML-like therapy. They should be treated with a hypomethylating agent. So here, everybody is correct. Now, why I picked the oral decitabine cedazuridine is because at ASH this past year, there was a very intriguing presentation, but from a prospective randomized phase 3 trial, that is the ASCERTAIN trial that led to the approval of oral decitabine, where to our surprise, I should say, there were actually very significant outcomes in P53 mutated patients, both mono and biallelic mutated P53 mutated patients with this oral decitabine cedazuridine. Why is that the case? I don't have a good explanation. but this is not a prospective, retrospective random selection. This is actually in the context of a prospective data. So I take that because this disease is so poor. I take that as any hope that I can give to my patients. And if I have the opportunity with the difficulties that David was telling us earlier of giving the oral decitabine, I don't know what will be the damage of doing that, the number one. The second issue is the transplant. This is actually highly controversial. I think everybody voted in favor of it. Yes. So this is very interesting because I was expecting some people to say no. Some people would say that maybe there is some futility in transplanting patients with P53 mutated disease. The way I approach this is that if the patient has a good response, and we can discuss what that means, I will consider the transplantation and then I will give them some post-transplant maintenance therapy. And if I had access to magrolimab, I think this is a very powerful agent in combination with an HMA for P53 mutated disease. And the ENHANCE study hopefully will give us access to this drug. And indeed, actually, this is already being done in AML, I understand, combination of HMA venetoclax plus CD47 antibody like magrolimab. So that's what was in my head. There is some small data that oral decitabine is maybe a little bit better than expected compared to to regular HMA in P53 mutated disease. But any HMA probably will be good. If I have a good response, I will try to give them opportunity by transplant. And if I have a drug like magrolimab, absolutely, I will use it. And I think everybody was kind of in agreement this time.
So, audience, here's a little bit of a snapshot of what you may be doing in the next 6 months or a year, depending upon when we see the data. Let's talk about what happened to this patient. This is an actual patient who went on a trial. What happened, David?
Yeah, so this patient, you know, again, for P53 and still today, if you can potentially get this patient on a study, like that is really what is optimal. Again, this sort of total therapy concept that I do give credit to Guillermo for coining, I think is really key, especially in this group. Actually, I want to put together even some of our data for post-transplant and maybe work with Guillermo on it, because I think this sort of concept, I do see patients having much better outcomes if we can molecularly clear them, get them to transplant, early initiation of HMA. You know, I'm starting to see many patients not early relapsing in that setting. So because of that, patient was enrolled on a trial. And of course, the main acute toxicity with magrolimab can be sort of these larger hemoglobin drops, especially the first week of therapy. And this is because old red blood cells do express paritmy signals. It's actually kind of one of our body's normal way to clear them. And so you can see these drops. And so it's quite easy to get around it. You know, you have to have their pre-dose hemoglobin higher. We have kept them above 9 g/dL on study. And you really have to check it again on that, at least that day one, day four. We also check day two and other days. So again, this very intense first week monitoring, but with that, as in this case, you sort of transfuse them through that. I think what's highlighted here is, again, the patient had an early response, both by hematopoietic recovery and blast clearance. But again, I think especially with magrolimab and more of an immune-mediated therapy, we've seen a number of patients deepen their response over time. You could see got to true CR after 4 cycles, and often molecular clearance and true CR do correlate together. And again, as that is one of my goals with my P53 patients, again, I think a little bit of a mistake would have been jumping off at cycle 2 and not getting through several more cycles of treatment. But ultimately, when a true CR and molecular clearance was obtained, this patient was bridged to allogeneic transplant, which does, you know, particularly in this group of patients, have good outcomes, especially with this molecular clearance.
So we asked the faculty a variation of this case, Guillermo. So this is the same 67-year-old man, but David, you wanted to see how the faculty would respond if the VAF was 10% and there was no complex karyotype. Guillermo, any thoughts?
Yeah, so this kind of shows the evolution of the complexity of the field. And this is actually not anecdote. Actually, you see this. So, you know, the implication actually is quite important. It'll come out in 10 seconds, and you already see it in the first column. So basically, this person has P53 mutation. Okay, a couple of years ago, we'll say, oh, that's bad. But actually, this patient has a relatively low VAF, and it happens to be in the context of a diploid karyotype, if I'm reading that correctly. Actually, a number of years ago, the German European group looked at this kind of combination of good, bad chromosomes with or without kind of P53, and we knew that there were some diploid patients with P53 mutations. Now we know majority of them actually have low VAFs. why is this so important? It's because, okay, he's young, he's 67. Now, actually, venetoclax may have a role here. Actually, you know, if the prior patient with a BAF of 55%, I don't know that many of us will go and give venetoclax. I think there was one of our colleagues, Dr. Borate, that added that. And I'm pretty sure I know why. I can discuss that at the end if I have time. But here, you know, with diploid cytogenetics, a low BAF, I don't see anything wrong adding venetoclax. And I think most of us, at least half of us, gave it. And then you will feel better about the transplant. And yes, if I had mogrolimab, absolutely, I will use it. But the point here is prognosis is much better. The outcome with transplant is much better. And this patient may do much better with venetoclax. So that detail of the chromosomes and the BAF really help a lot here.
So, David, the biology that you went through and the data that we have available on the issue of TP53 disease was really fascinating in your presentation. Can you kind of summarize your vision of this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously we had this controversial start to tonight's you know, webinar, but I do think, again, however we want to call it, and I share Guillermo's, you know, passion in that I think this is an MDS disease. I think that to me is not the question, but I think for P53, and again, really, if you look at this curve B, this is the largest data set from the Hovon group where AML is in red and MDS with excess blast, and this is greater than 5%. So again, different than this sort of 10% cutoff. The curves are superimposable, and this isn't one data set. There's at least three that have really shown, you know, this. So again, this excess blast P53 group has a uniform prognosis. And again, the majority of these patients are multi-hit. Again, we just talked about some of the importance at looking at the monoallelics versus not. But in this excess blast patient, this is one disease. And I think the biggest thing is we need to change the standard of care. This is worse than metastatic pancreatic cancer. Okay. And so we really need to pull these out. These patients should not be in all of the wild type trials. They actually may have killed a bunch of wild type trials, you know, and Guillermo's actually talked, you know, a lot about this at the same time. So I think both for the pro of really improving this group by itself, as well as some of the con of maybe negatively influencing agents that could have activity, this group has to be investigated by itself. And we need to get the FDA really on board to some of this molecular harmonization and thinking about this disease as one and not something separate. I could tell you if magrolimab gets it approved, nobody in the world is going to care, at least nobody in the US is going to care, you know, whether or not they say MDS or AML, because we're going to be thinking about adding that therapy in that setting.
And, you know, we're seeing this in solid tumor oncology also in terms of targeted therapy, you know, HER2 now, you know, people, various tumors using the same therapy. Guillermo, can you talk a little bit about sort of what CD47 does and what magrolimab does?
Actually, it's a very interesting concept. It was discovered by Dr. Weissman group at Stanford, actually probably around 15 years or more ago. So people were interested, of course, in this concept of immune checkpoint inhibitors as an evading mechanism for cancer cells, leukemia cells against T cells. And basically what happens here is kind of the same process, but through macrophage. So basically, by having this CD47, these cancer cells, because this concept actually may apply not only to MDS and AML, but to other disorders, and there's data in lymphoma, actually may evade macrophage phagocytic activity. So if you block that process with an antibody against some aspect of this machinery, in this case, the CD47, you basically promote phagocytosis. And what is really interesting from this is that it should be agnostic of the mutational profile. And I think going back to what David was saying, you know, why this was so attractive to us in the P53 context was because, you know, there's in principle not a specific reason why a macrophage should distinguish a P53 mutated leukemic blast versus one that is not. So that is why I think we are also excited and interested about this pathway. So it's basically an immune checkpoint for macrophages, as this photo shows. And by blocking this interaction, now you render these cells phagocytic again. And I think that slide actually has a beautiful video where you see actually these cells eating the leukemic blast. So it's quite actually fascinating. And again, the fact that may not be related to mutational profile of the disease makes it very appealing, as opposed to, for instance, BCL2 inhibition, where we know that, for instance, P53 is kind of a resistant, not mechanisms per se, but feature of that kind of leukemia. So this could be a big differentiating piece of data where you will say, I'm going to use venetoclax or not, or I'm going to use magrolimab, or hopefully maybe triplets. I don't know. But this will be an important point in the future if both studies are positive.
So, David, can you talk a little bit about the clinical research data we have available? Of course, you go through this in depth in your presentation, but maybe kind of provide a little bit of an overview of what we know about this.
Yeah, so essentially this is a very large, you know, phase one, you know, trial in both higher risk MDS patients. Again, again, even speaking again to the molecular IPSS versus IPSSR, you know, all of these novel doublets are in the era of the IPSSR as far as classification. So intermediate to very high risk patients, no discrimination based on blast cutoff. And then similarly, an AML cohort that was almost exclusively AML, and I can talk about, you know, that data set a little bit. This just speaks to the importance of saturating the receptor. So in our body, CD47 is expressed everywhere. Okay, and so there is a lot of antigen that you need to have bound. What's fortunate is that if you don't have a pro-ITME signal, you know, which is largely, you know, only, you know, cancer cells, old red blood cells that we talked about, you won't get any cytotoxicity against our normal self. So that's why this therapy has been well tolerated. But what this showed here is, you know, a while into the trial, we switched from weekly to every other week dosing, more for patient convenience, and we could keep saturation. What's important is as you get past that 2-week mark, this could start to go down quickly. And so keeping people on magrolimab, and this is something actually we kind of learned from the phase one into the phase three, is important. We may even thought we lost a little bit of efficacy towards the end of the phase one trial for patients that had, let's say, holds for cytopenias that may have been more azer-related. So it's just the importance about keeping patients on drug. And actually, if you look at some 47 therapy that have failed, they did not have 100% saturation. And I think if you don't get that, you may really lose a lot of synergy, which was really the emphasis of that slide. Again, safety has been good. We talked a lot about the anemia. I think there's maybe a slide in a moment just focusing on that. Yeah, this is right here. Again, we get this large drop. We've talked about it. It's really predominantly a day one. Even day four is often quite minimal. But over time, this is not an issue. Of course, many patients having hematologic response. And so there, you know, we've had patients past 3 years on magrolimab therapy. And actually a nice abstract, I don't think it's been published yet, was presented at ASCO a year ago by the Stanford group, showed that actually red blood cells in the setting of chronic magrolimab exposure actually prune or lose their CD47 expression. And that may be why we don't really see, you know, recurrent on-target anemia later on. So again, this is a first week issue more than anything else. It can have issues like daratumumab in interacting with blood bank, depending on what your reagents use. For example, we use these Immunocore reagents. We've not had issues, but again, at certain areas, I think they may have issues similar to daratumumab. Again, we have this 3/4 of patients that have responded, and most of these responses are associated with hematologic response. This was kind of emphasized in the case here. And so that you could see that the CR, which is kind of this orangish red color, these happen over time. Many, you know, the median time to CR was in the sort of 3 to 4 months, but actually we had CRs occurring past 6 months. So speaking, again, giving this time to have their most optimal response is important. It's a little different than venetoclax, where most patients may really get their best response between cycles 1 and 2, was really the emphasis here. You know, this was the median survival follow-up. You can see that the median OS was not reached with a follow-up of 17 months, although it's clearly approaching 50%. So I think what's important is to parse this by the P53 mutation status. You know, and then in wild type, over 60% of patients were alive versus an OS of about 16 months, which is the best OS, at least in high-risk P53 patients that we have seen. And then just emphasizing sort of, again, this concept of total therapy. To me, this is one of the most important secondary endpoints across these novel doublets is how are our patients doing with transplant. You know, one thing that's remarkable is, you know, almost 40% of this whole cohort, this is an elderly cohort of patients, went to transplant. And I think this speaks to the quality of response, the performance status improvements. And you can see our two-year OS of 77%. That's versus probably historical of about 40% in this sort of exact patient setting. Granted, this is a trial population. And again, this just looked at that sort of P53 mutant versus wild type that I spoke about. We didn't have a lot of P53 mutant patients transplanted, but again, those patients, for what it's worth, did quite reasonable. And then I think lastly, Yeah, I think just maybe real one quick question. Yeah, one quick point here is, you know, MRD has not been a thing in MDS. Clearly, it's been revolutionary in AML. Actually, I think this is one of the first prospective cohorts to look at this. This is with a multi-parameter flow cytometry with a cutoff between at 0.02%, so quite sensitive. And you could see that it was predictive. And maybe not, this is not shock and awe, but I do think as we get combinations that are really effective, I do think looking at MRD negativity is going to have some important implications, especially when we think about what's our next wave into the future.
Guillermo, any thoughts?
No, David actually led all the studies from the phase one, and he really should get all the credit because this could be really transformative for our patients. Particularly that data on the P53 context is really important.
David, any comments? You mentioned the idea of a triplet with magrolimab, AZA-VEN and magrolimab. Can you comment on the ENHANCE study, this phase three study? I think this is really what you're pointing towards in terms of magrolimab coming into practice. Can you comment on this? And also other studies that are going on right now in AML with magrolimab, David?
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, the triplet's been actually been led by Guillermo's group, by Naval Daver, Guillermo, at that institution. Actually, has some really exciting data that supports these, at least the ENHANCE 3 trial, which is a sort of trying to change the all-comer standard of care for elderly AML of looking at triplet versus doublet. As far as the ENHANCE, again, similar design to Verona, OS-powered study, 500-patient study. We're all eagerly awaiting the data to be read out, hopefully in the near future. And then separately is that P53 group. So, you know, the only P53 ongoing prospective, you know, trial right now is the ENHANCE 2, which is AZA-VEN versus AZA-MIGROLIMAB, and it's age independent. You know, the FDA is also recognizing that independent of age, fitness, it's a group that does poor, and we need to change the standard of care. So I'm actually more excited personally about ENHANCE 2 than ENHANCE 3. And there is an oral decitabine concept within MyeloMATCH, you know, speaking to Guillermo's point of sort of, oral therapy in that setting in AML, you know, as well.
So just to close out with a few practical issues, Guillermo, that we asked in the survey. One is, do you think that medical oncologists are going to be administering magrolimab and dealing with these issues related to transfusion? The faculty seems a little bit split about that. We also asked how frequently the hemoglobin should be measured during the first week of treatment. And you can see pretty frequently, I think at least three times a week, if not more. How difficult is it going to be to deal with the hemoglobin? It sounds like most people think it is something that is sort of manageable. Guillermo, any comments about sort of these practical issues in using the drug?
So I agree with what David was saying, that, you know, these mitigation strategies really work. But, you know, we admit at MD Anderson patients for venetoclax combinations. And our goal in my center with these first 4 weeks of therapy with any of these therapies actually is to make sure that you have 0% mortality. And that's actually how you have a great response rate. And then that's maybe why you have better survival rates. So I think with the magrolimab, you know, you need this blood bank issue. You really need to be on top of the hemoglobin at baseline. You may need to transfuse these patients. I don't see how we're going to do this safely in the outpatient setting. That will be an lot of work for most of us during the first couple of weeks, at least. So the safe way and the most, I think, effective way to do this right now will be to make sure that you have nurses that are trained, the blood bank is trained. So basically, this will have to be done, and it's the right thing to do. There is nothing wrong with that in situations where the whole team is kind of familiar with this approach. I don't think this can be done really today. I mean, it can be done, but I would not recommend that this is done outpatient. We need to do the best for our patients, and you have therapy that is so incredible, like this kind of doublets with overall response rates, you know, let's say 80%, will you cut corners? No, you will do the best thing for your patient. Nothing wrong with doing this in the inpatient setting, in my opinion.
So I got to say, a few years ago, it was kind of challenging to think about spending an hour on MDS, but now in an hour, we barely even touched this. It's so exciting. So we didn't even get into targeted therapy, IDH, et cetera. So much more content in the two presentations you both did. Guillermo and David, thank you so much for working with us on this project. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back on Thursday, same time, same place, here about a whole bunch of new immunotherapies I've never heard of, and probably you haven't either. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Guillermo.
Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, David.
Bye, David. Thank you.